I think that this sketch is the most lifelike I have ever, or realistic that I've ever seen. Within 1 hour of releasing it, a prison guard recognized the man and calls Huntsville Police Department, and he says, "I know who your killer is."
It's Tuesday, and you're listening to Murder Unscripted.
My name's Ed, and for the past 2 decades, I've been producing true crime content for some of your favorite networks like Hulu, Oxygen, and of course, Investigation Discovery.
And I'm Melissa, Ed's bestie and walking, talking true crime database.
We've combined my behind-the-scenes insight with Melissa's morbid curiosity to bring you a podcast that immerses you in the true crime genre like never before.
We highlight victims' cases and bring you exclusive insight from the people who lived through them, with a touch of humor to lighten even the darkest stories.
This is Murder Unscripted.
Dun dun dun.
What is happening, crime crew? Welcome to episode 77 of Murder Unscripted, the most immersive true crime podcast on the internet today. I'm your host, Ed Hydock, here with my bestie, Melissa White Meat Spivey.
I don't even know what that means, but yes, incredibly pale.
You're what? Yeah.
Oh, Thanksgiving. Yes. Well, that's right. Happy November.
We're 2 weeks into November now.
You're
and
right.
You forgot
I
last
know.
Week. Like, we're in November.
It's been a day.
Well, we are in the second week of our block entitled Drawn to Justice, where we are discussing crimes in which a sketch was created and this would ultimately help solve the case. And last week, with the case of Ardeth Woods in Ottawa, Canada, we saw how sketches, when they're released to the media, they can be incredibly helpful. They can break the case wide open, but it can also lead to a ton of like false leads, ultimately making the investigation incredibly difficult, which Ardeth was.
Yeah, didn't they get something like 4,000 tips within X amount of months?
Yeah, and they did eventually catch the guy, which is really all that matters. And if you would actually like to check out our coverage of Ardeth's case, I think we did a pretty good job. You can click on the link here, and this is a new feature we're trying out. So if it's not here, you can just scroll over here to Google and find it yourself. I'm not entirely sure how these links work. So I'm going to point right here and hope it appears.
It's totally going to be there.
Well, before we jump in, I would like to remind everyone that if you guys like what you're hearing from Murder Unscripted, please take a moment to like, subscribe, rate us on Apple and Spotify. Humongous help. Helps more than you guys know. Mm-hmm. With that out of the way, Melissa, spin us a tale.
All right. Well, my case today is wild. And it actually would have been a really great case for a few other themes we've covered, especially the case that haunts me block, because this case, and we're now 40 years out, it continues to haunt the investigators who worked on it.
Oh, wow.
When I was researching, I watched an episode of Forensic Files 2. And like I said, like the one guy, the deputy who worked on one of the murders that I'm going to tell you about, he just completely broke down, like sobbing in this interview.
Wow, because Forensic Files 2 is so bad.
I don't want to say it's bad, but it's just not the same without Peter.
They could have got his son, who sounds just like him. But as the old Polish antidote goes, not my circus, not my monkeys. So... Forensic Files 1 was great, and that's all we care about.
And Peter was great.
Mm-hmm. Great man.
In addition to the Forensic Files 2 episode and a ton of news articles, I also listened to a book entitled The Demon Next Door, which was written by Brian Burrow. And this Brian guy, he actually went to school with the killer.
Oh, shit.
He was like a couple years behind him, but yeah, like they kind of grew up together. He didn't really know him, but he knew of him.
That's interesting because Catherine last week talked about that, how she wasn't that interested in who was the Unabomber, but then a book came out from the Unabomber that's girl that lived next door to him. So that was like a whole new perspective. So I think it's so cool when unusual POVs end up writing books about the cases that we all have heard so much about.
Yeah. And the book was well done. It highlighted several interesting themes, like including how these serial killers that are so horrific, they can just blend into society and look like you or me.
Ted Bundy.
And the book also talks about how people and like even an entire community can really get tunnel visioned and just kind of be blinded to the evil of others. Like you just don't want to believe that someone could be so terrible.
Very true.
Well, this case is super complex and I would love to discuss every aspect, but I only have about an hour before Ed starts playing the wrap-up music.
That's what we're doing today.
Summary.
We're fighting, I get it. Well, by all means, talk for 3 hours about a case. I'm sure people will be on the edge of their seat.
They're going to love it. You're just not going to love editing it. All right. Well, we are leaving my comfort zone of the 1990s, but we're going just back a few years to the year I was born, 1987. And we are in Huntsville, Texas. And on the map, Huntsville is about an hour north of Houston and about 2.25 hours south of Dallas.
Okay.
So it's kind of right in the middle. So Huntsville is home to the Huntsville unit of the Texas State Prison System, which, fun fact, is the oldest Texas state prison. It opened in 1849. And I don't know if this next fact is bragging rights or not, but the Huntsville unit is the most active execution chamber in the United States.
Wow. Even for Texas, that's saying something.
So that's something. But spoiler alert, we will be coming back to this exact execution chamber at the end of our case today. But before the execution takes place in 1998, we need to talk about what got us there. It's Halloween night, October 31st, 1987, and Deputy Dusty Dalger, which, by the way, that sounds like a Marvel name, like Peter Parker and Bruce Banner.
If that is your real name.
Exactly. Well, Deputy Dusty Dalger is spending the night trick-or-treating with his family, and the night starts out great. They're having great family time, lots of fun, but it would end up being the most haunting night of Deputy Dalger's career.
I'm guessing it had nothing to do with ghouls and goblins.
Nope, unfortunately. I feel like that would have been better.
Yeah.
So it's shortly after 10 p.m., and the Halloween festivities are slowly winding down, when Deputy Dalger's police radio starts crackling. Over the radio, he hears that a woman was attacked at a local do-it-yourself car wash, like not far from where the deputy lived. So he hops in his truck and he rushes over to this car wash. And when he arrives, it looks like a war zone.
Oh, wow.
In one of the wash stalls, there's a white 1984 Cadillac, and laying on the ground next to it is the body of 36-year-old Mary Risinger, just covered in blood. It's so spooky because there's a picture, and the hose that she had just been rinsing her car with is like tucked underneath her with water still spewing out.
Oh,
and it's just, it's really creepy.
Almost like it's frozen in time.
Oh, well, if that isn't enough to horrify anyone, inside of that white Cadillac is the victim's 3-year-old daughter.
Oh, my God.
And she's physically unharmed, but mentally, she's incredibly traumatized.
Yeah, you think? Like, I don't remember much before I was five. You know, I think that's when, like, my first memories exist. But I imagine that if something awful happened like that, it might be etched into my brain. Like, I don't know. I think kids under three don't remember much. I think I've heard that. However, it can lead to, like, traumatic memories coming back way later in life.
I don't know, but I mean, I think this, I feel like you would remember. I feel like your brain can't block that unless it does completely block it out as like a coping mechanism.
Maybe.
Well, we find out later that Mary and her daughter, Kristen, who was just about a month shy of her 4th birthday, they had been out enjoying the Halloween festivities at the local fairgrounds. And on their way home, Mary decided to stop at this car wash. So Mary's washing the car. Kristen, she's in her little ballerina Halloween costume.
Oh, cute.
She's like running around and splashing in the water puddles and like running in front of the hose. And while Mary's finishing up, she's like rinsing the car off when another car pulls up into the stall next to her. And a man gets out and just suddenly he rushes over to Mary. He grabs her from behind and begins trying to drag her to his car. And Mary's fighting like a badass because this is a mama and like her child is right there. Like she's going to go crazy.
Right.
But unfortunately, she was no match for this man, especially since the man had a knife. And he must have realized, though, that he was quickly losing control of the situation because suddenly he took his knife and violently slashed Mary's throat.
That is insane. Like, what a wholesome moment. Like, that stuff you just described with her daughter playing in the water and the puddles and stuff. Like, that's a core memory shattered in the most horrific way possible. That's awful.
It gets worse, though. According to later court documents, he apparently severed every major blood vessel in her neck.
Brutal.
Thank God, though, he didn't notice little Kristen, and she had taken refuge in the car at this point.
Oh, no kidding. Well, I wonder if she was out spraying the hose, if he, like, did see her and just had a moment of conscience or something, because if she's out playing, you'd think she'd be hard to miss.
I think it was definitely a crime of opportunity, spur of the moment. Maybe she was on the other side of the car. I don't know.
True.
Luckily, he left her alone. Well, after slitting Mary's throat, the man runs back to his car and he, like, peels out of there and takes off. So witnesses, because yes, there were witnesses to this, and I will get back to them in a second. But one of them called the police, and with minutes, that's when our deputy Duggar was on site. So by now, Kristen had locked herself in the car, and Duggar went to the window and told her, like, he's like, I'm a police officer, and she didn't open the door, so he, like, showed her his badge. And, like, he's like, I'm here to help you. And so she cautiously unlocked the car door. And in the Forensic Files episode, Duggar talks about how, like, she literally launched herself into his arms and would not let go of this man.
Oh, I'm sure.
She, like, the whole night was, like, clinging to him. And, like, he told her, he's like, you're safe now. And she asked him, please protect me from the bad man. He killed my mama.
Oh, my God. It's heartbreaking.
This is the part in the Forensic Files 2 episode that this, like, Duggar, this, like, rough, seasoned veteran homicide detective starts, like, crying, like, breaking down into tears as he recounts this night.
Well, yeah, whenever there's a little kid involved, I feel like we don't know if this officer had a, if Duggar, if he had a daughter, if he had a niece.
Well, Duggar goes on to talk about how he originally thought Kristen's ballerine costume was red. But then he found out it wasn't. She was just covered from head to toe in her mother's blood. And they show some black and white pictures. It's almost like they took her mugshot, but I guess they just had to take a picture of her. And it's sweet because you can tell she's like holding on to the detective or the deputy.
He's got to feel a strange bond with this girl, like as long as he lives.
So real quick, I want to go back to those witnesses. Basically, Kristen was, of course, the best witness the police had, but there had been other people in the vicinity of the car wash who had witnessed, like, the entire attack and murder.
Did anyone try to stop him?
No, actually.
Wow, really?
It's awful. So, a November 3rd, 1987 article in the Houston Chronicle states, quote, witnesses to the incident say they saw the woman fighting with a man outside her car at the car wash. They did not intervene because the woman appeared to be winning, and they thought it was a boyfriend-girlfriend type thing. End
what?
Quote.
Like, what are they, like, ringside judges? What does that matter? Like, I feel like a fight between two people, like men, women, couples, whatever, I would at least say, like, yo, cut it out, or is everything okay?
You good? Yeah, something. And I love that they're cool with the attack on a woman as long as it's by her boyfriend.
Yeah,
they're
isn't
like,
that
oh,
messed
it's
up?
Fine. What kind of relationships do you people have? Like, now I'm worried for you.
Yeah, for real.
Well, in talking to these useless witnesses, police were, they were able to put together a composite sketch of this man. And then due to the shock and trauma of everything, little Kristen, she was not pushed really by investigators to give a statement, which I'm really happy about.
Well, yeah, especially back then, I highly doubt that any police department would have like a child psychologist on staff or trained to deal with this kind of trauma. You know, I mean, it's such a young kid. There's a certain way you have to go about it.
Absolutely. And like, I think they eventually did get to speak with her a little bit, but she really was of little help.
Yeah, she's so young.
Yeah. So other than the composite sketch, police didn't really have anything to go on. And Mary's case just went cold pretty quickly. Like, this is 1987, so DNA is really in its infancy. Surveillance cameras are few and far between and pretty much non-existent in Huntsville, Texas.
Well, yeah, and I guarantee there's a 99.9% chance that they weren't working even if they had them, so.
Or they were, like, decoy ones.
Yes, the fake.
Yeah.
I like this. I put the stickers up that said in your window, like protected by a security system. It's like, hope no one actually looks around for said security system.
Yeah, right. I'm going to go rob his up. Never mind. He's got the sticker.
He got stickers everywhere.
Well, on top of all that, there was absolutely no physical evidence at the crime scene. No fingerprints, no murder weapon, just nada. So investigators are very frustrated, and they're not just frustrated about Mary's murder, but they actually had had a similar murder just a few months prior, and that case was just as cold as Mary's.
We got a spree killer on our hands.
Maybe. I don't know what this guy would be considered. I guess a serial killer.
Interesting.
So a little over 3 months before Mary's murder, another young woman had been murdered in a case where investigators had basically nothing to go on just from the jump. Like, they started out with nothing. Mm-hmm. So on July 10th, 1987, 27-year-old Deborah Ewing, she had been abducted from her job at the Huntsville Vision Center, which was located in this brand new shopping center not far from Interstate 45, which connects Houston and Dallas, and it runs right through Huntsville. You know how that goes. If you get abducted and it's right near the highway, they can jump on and be God knows where within minutes.
I'm surprised, though. I mean, you mentioned this brand new shopping center. It's strange to hear a story about an abduction right there. It's a very brazen place to do it, I feel like.
Yeah, we'll get to that in a second. But Deborah was working there as an optician in the Vision Center, which it and the shopping center, they had only been open for about 2 weeks at that point. And going back to what you said about being brand new, I'm not sure how the surrounding area was, like, safety-wise. I don't know if it was a good neighborhood or a bad neighborhood. I couldn't really get a feel for it.
Yeah.
But it should be noted that Deborah had expressed concern to her boss at least twice in those 2 weeks about having to be alone in the store, like, working by herself. And clearly, her boss didn't take those concerns very seriously, since Deborah was working alone the day that she was abducted by a man at gunpoint.
That is so frustrating. Like, you bring your concern to an employer and they do nothing about it. And now look what happened.
It's a hard situation, because if it's not a busy store, it's like they don't make enough money to justify having two people. But then someone gets put in a position like this.
Yeah.
Well, I don't have a ton of background information about Deborah, which, you know, I hate that. But I can tell you what I did find. So first of all, Deborah is stunning. And she had actually pursued a modeling career prior to becoming an optician.
Okay.
She actually, I thought she reminded me of Susan Woods. We covered her murder last year in, I think, September.
That was early. Yeah, Susan was gorgeous. She was incredibly gorgeous. And you know what? She was from Stephenville, Texas. That's where that crime happened. And I don't think that's that far from Huntsville, maybe a couple hours. That's crazy you brought her up.
Well, Deborah and her husband of 5 years, a gentleman named Wayne Ewing, they lived in the small town of Grangerland, Texas, which was like 45 minutes south of Huntsville and where the Vision Center was. And I couldn't find out much about Deborah and Wayne's relationship, but there didn't seem to be any trouble. I know Wayne had been really worried about Deborah working at the Vision Center, especially since only 3 days prior to her abduction, Deborah had actually called the police regarding a man who had been lurking in the parking lot outside of the Vision Center.
So not only did she tell her manager that she was concerned, but now there's this guy lurking outside. Like, that is messed up. Like, dude. Don't even just be a manager, be a decent human being. Like, this girl is clearly scared, and now there's proof she has good reason to be scared.
And it's so hard to know. Like, I wonder if the boss was like, oh, she's just being dramatic, or I wonder if the boss was actively trying to hire someone. Like, I wish we knew.
Yeah. And different times, too. Like, I feel like you were just thrown in dangerous situations back then because it's just what you did.
That's true. And we don't know for certain, but we're pretty sure that this guy lurking a few days prior was not the man who would ultimately abduct and kill her. In an article after her murder, it was stated that police had spoken to that man caught lurking and there was no connection. So whether or not that changed when they did find the killer, I'm not sure. It was not ever brought up again. So on that Friday, July 10th, we don't have a ton of information about all that happened, but what we do have comes from an eyewitness. It's a woman named Gina Schoenfield, and she was the office manager in the Prudential Financial Services office, which was located right next to the Vision Center. So Gina was alone, she's working in her office, and at about 4:30 p.m., Deborah ran in the front door screaming, "Help, there's a man outside with a gun." So Gina's like super confused and she turns to look, but she couldn't fully see the man as he was obscured by the blinds in the office.
Okay.
She was like, I don't know what's happening, but holy crap. So she like quickly dives into the closest office. Yeah. She slams the door and she hides under the desk while she frantically calls police. And We know Deborah at least made it to the front of that store. We don't really know, though, what happened other than the gunman was clearly able to overpower and abduct her within seconds, though, because just a few minutes after Gina called 911, police were already on the scene. Like, super quick.
Yeah, like, she probably was yelling for this girl to get help, and he runs by and just swipes her.
Yeah. Like, wow. And so the police were able to get there so quickly because it just so happens that an officer had been patrolling, like, right around the corner. So, but, like, even with that quick response, Deborah and her abductor were long gone. It's crazy the short amount of time before police got there.
Yeah, you can't blame police on this one. Wow.
No, definitely not. Well, 2 days later, on Sunday, July 12th, a realtor and her client were touring a property when they came upon a foul odor.
Oh, man. Yeah, we're talking July in Texas. Enough said.
Mm-hmm. Well, then about 100 yards off of a dirt road near the lakefront property on Lake Conroe, they came upon the body of Deborah Ewing. She was naked from the waist down, and we eventually find out that she had been raped before she was stabbed multiple times in the chest. It was determined she had most likely been dead since Friday, which is the day she was abducted.
So sad.
I know. So, similar to Mary's case, there were very few leads. Like, nothing in the Vision Center had been disturbed. Nothing was stolen. And because of that, investigators weren't sure if the abductor had even come into the Vision Center. And, like, if he did somehow Deborah run past him to the door? Or maybe she saw him coming from the parking lot and she ran out of the store right before he even got there?
Yeah, I guess you'll never know without cameras.
Exactly. We have no idea. And I do know that they really looked hard at her husband. I don't want to say they got tunnel vision, but I think they spent a lot of time on him when they had other leads.
I feel like if it were a husband, and like it would be more calculated, more pre, like he would know your schedule instead of just grabbing somebody as they're working at a store running. You know what I mean? It doesn't make sense.
And not only, like, why would you be so obvious about it? Everyone's right. Going to know you. And I just feel like that's a dumb time to do it.
You got to clear them. I mean, but I would think if anything, it would be a hitman the husband hired. Like, if the husband did have something to do with it.
Right.
But it wouldn't be him directly. That doesn't seem to even make sense.
I completely agree. I think they wasted some time with that. Well, after Mary's murder on Halloween, things stayed quiet for several months, but we all know that these kinds of monsters cannot keep their maniacal urges dormant for long, and just shy of a year after killing Mary, this garbage bag of a human would strike again.
Wow, a year. So he waited.
Yeah.
So spree killers are what? Just multiple victims in a short span.
Yeah, but so I think it has to be less than like 20 days or something. Yeah.
So you're definitely not a spree killer.
No. But I think with only two, you're not a serial killer until you're at three.
No. Yeah, you're in limbo.
Unless he is and we haven't gotten there. We'll see.
You're just a prick at this point.
Yes, exactly. So now we're in October of 1988. And it's around noontime, and Texas A&M student Wendy Gant, she's on campus, and she's walking to her car for a lunch break between classes. She was an avid equestrian, and she was actually going to visit her horse. So Wendy's getting into her car when a man came up behind her, bound her hands behind her back, and forced her into her own car. She had a big blue and white Suburban. It was her mom's car. She was borrowing it because hers was like in the shop or something.
Okay.
He peels out of the parking lot and proceeds to drive Wendy about 20 minutes away from campus. And they go out to like this rural and isolated section of Lick Creek Park, which I don't love the name of it.
No, it's tough. Okay. Not only is it suggestive, but it's also very tough to pronounce.
Yes, Lick Creek Park. Yeah.
Yeah, a lot of K's.
Well, when they arrived, he pulled Wendy from the car and demanded that she undress. And because her abductor had a knife, Wendy did as she was told. Well, once she was naked, this monster sexually assaulted her. He beat her, and then he stabbed her before plunging his knife into Wendy's throat.
God.
Wendy falls to the ground, and basically assuming he killed her and assuming his victim's dead, the man walks away and goes to Wendy's car. He would eventually dump the car in a public lot, and I'm not sure if he took it back to the university campus or not. Nothing specified that. What this shitbag didn't realize, Wendy was a friggin' badass, and she was only pretending to be dead.
Oh, no kidding. Good for her.
Yeah, she's alive. So in the Forensic Files 2 episode, they talk about how Wendy was like, if I'm going to die, I am not going to die in a place where I will never be found.
Wow, like, that's heroic.
Yes, like at least let me get somewhere where they will find my body. So despite her horrible injuries and the fact that her throat was slit so deeply that she could not speak, let alone scream, this incredible young woman somehow managed to muster up the strength to drag herself to the closest road. And luckily at that point, a passing motorist found her and she was taken to a hospital where she was rushed into surgery.
The survivors that we cover, they will never cease to amaze me. Like, to hear their stories is so inspiring, I guess, in their own way.
Well, Wendy thankfully survived. And when she was, like, conscious and coherent enough, and she realized she was unable to speak due to the damage to her throat, we'll put up pictures, but you can see all the stitches. But the first thing she did, she indicated that she needed paper and, like, something to write with. So she takes this pen and paper and she immediately writes down two things. The first was, who is feeding my horse? Please go feed him.
Priorities.
And two, get me a sketch artist.
No kidding.
So police reached out to a forensic sketch artist, Karen T. Taylor. And Karen is an incredibly famous forensic artist and she's especially big in Texas. And side note, Karen Taylor did the sketches of the suspect in the Austin yogurt shop murders. And
she did.
If you compare her drawings to Robert Brasher's picture, it is on point. The eyes are so wild how she matched them. It's creepy. We can post a picture of that.
She's pretty incredible. So Karen's a very good friend of mine, dating back to like the Forensic Files days, because some of the cases we cover, especially Texas ones, she would appear all the time. And you can tell her work. There's a little KTT. And I actually reached out to her to be a guest for this month. That's kind of how we formed this block idea. And she turned us down politely. Not because of any, she just doesn't do podcasts. And she also had a workshop that she was getting ready for in November.
She's actually in the Forensic Files episode. And she's talking about how originally her supervisor didn't even want her to take this on because they thought it was going to be impossible to create a sketch when the victim was unable to verbally describe the suspect. Well, Karen was not deterred, and while this was admittedly one of the most difficult, if not the most difficult drawings of her career, she nailed it. And in the show, she explained how she used a lot of open-ended questions. Like, she asked, what type of guy was he? Was he a cowboy? Was he a rocker? Was he a jock? She and Wendy spent hours together, like hours, perfecting this sketch, and Karen said that when it was done, both she and Wendy were so happy with how it turned out.
Well, you know what? I actually can't wait. That guest we were just talking about, he's going to explain how many other factors go into creating a sketch, like outside elements that you have to take into account. So I'm actually really excited to bring him to you guys.
He has a really amazing way of doing these drawings that I'm really excited to ask him about.
Yeah, it's not just the obvious, like what shape were the eyes? There's right. So much more.
So much more that I never would have ever thought of.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, so they have this sketch of our suspect. Now, Ed, you have not seen the sketch in the picture. So I want you to go to tab 4 where I have sketch and picture, and I want you to look at it and tell me what you think.
Tabs exist.
I know. Tabs. This is fancy.
Do we need me to describe him? Is that what we're doing?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so he looks like Dahmer a little bit. So he's got just a regular short haircut, big glasses with the bar across the middle, and a stash and a flannel shirt. Yep. I mean, he reminds me of Dahmer with a mustache.
I think it's the glasses. My brother has those, and I tell him they're serial killer glasses.
But he does, when we get to the end of the story, he looks pretty damn close to the guy.
It's wild. Like I said, before we started this, I was explaining it to Ed and I said, I think that this sketch is the most lifelike I have ever, or realistic that I've ever seen.
Yeah, it's really good.
So police take this sketch and they release it to the media. Within 1 hour of releasing it, A prison guard recognized the man and calls Huntsville Police Department, and he says, I know who your killer is. It's really? Daniel Lee Corwin.
Shut up.
Within 1 hour. Isn't that crazy? Like, that's how realistic this looks. Or
yeah.
Well, Daniel Lee Corwin was no stranger to police. He had allegedly committed his first sexual assault when he was 14 years old against a 13-year-old.
How are you at 14 even thinking about this? I mean, you're obviously starting to think about girls. That's the age where girls become interesting, at least for me. But to think about that is so advanced for a young mind.
We're going to get back to this, but Daniel Lee Corwin was born on September 13th, 1958, to Phil and Nancy Corwin. I think she went by Nan. Okay. So sources differ on how many siblings he had. The information that I found the most often was that he was one of four siblings, so we will go with that.
Okay.
And the Corwins were deeply religious, and I think that they meant well, but they didn't necessarily deal with their problems so well. They believed that their problems could be solved with prayer. And depending on your beliefs, I do think that prayer can be a very helpful tool. However, I think that there are certain things that you have to take a different approach in finding a resolution to.
I get that you need something to believe in. Totally get that. But I do feel like sometimes it would be more beneficial to be practical.
Right. Agreed. And unfortunately, little Danny Corwin was definitely a closeted monster from a very young age. According to that Demon Next Door book, one time after a fight with his sister, Corwin killed her cat.
Oh my God.
Yeah. Also from the book, at some point, Corwin admitted to a psychologist, it was a prison psychologist, but he admitted that he had had sex with animals when he was younger. And while this next thing seems very minor in comparison to cat murder and bestiality, Daniel wet the bed from childhood through like sometime during adolescence.
See, it seems in like unimportant, but I mean, cruelty to animals, bedwetting, there are two gigantic red flags when it comes to a child and a potential future as the really bad person. Like, it, you know, and I said potential, like obviously not all, but it's a, what was that? The McDonald triad?
Yes, McDonald triad. Fires, setting fires, killing animals, and bedwetting. He's this all-American, clean-cut, Boy Scout-looking kid. And along with his family, they all spent so much free time at the church. And they would get together at night and play board games. And it's like, it's almost like from the outside, they're this Leave It to Beaver type family. And there are certainly no records of abuse or anything super out of the ordinary. I know the family did go through some financial issues which led to instability with their living arrangements.
I think people underestimate financial hardships and like what it can do to a family. Like there's that old saying, like money can't buy happiness, but what it can buy is stability. And like that stability, like I feel carries over into every facet of your life. You're just happier when you don't have to worry about things.
There's literally not one problem I have that money couldn't solve.
That's a fact.
Like,
yeah.
I will make a list. Well, and it seems like at one point, the parents, they had to move out of their house, and the parents were living in like a camper of some sort while the kids were sleeping outside in a tent.
Wow. That's struggles.
So it's, I don't know. There was a lot of family dynamics going on.
Yeah.
Well, Daniel didn't do super well in school, and he wasn't considered popular. He was just kind of this timid, shy kid who seemed to fade into the background. However, he had an extreme need to be praised by adults, especially his parents. Like, he always wanted to be the teacher's pet, and he just wanted to be his parents' favorite kid. Like, he craved approval and recognition so intensely that it seemed to drive every move he made.
See, this kind of stuff, like, seems like a kid just being needy, but it can absolutely shape them as adults, I feel. Like, getting that validation solidifies your sense of self-worth. I know that much, but you absolutely carry that into adulthood. So if a kid that needs that isn't getting it, like, I assume it can lead to a lot of self-doubt and setting these, like, ridiculously high standards that you know you will never meet, and it's like a fast-track to burnout.
Yeah, and that could definitely be what happened here. But something went very wrong, because when Daniel was 14, so this is like 1972-ish, again, sources differed on some dates, so I'm going with what I heard the most. So Daniel and his family, they lived next door to this young couple, the Finns, and this couple had recently had a baby, and one night they were like, we need a break from being parents, which everybody needs. So they hired a local 13-year-old girl from the neighborhood who we're going to call Beverly. Her name is out there, but she was a 13-year-old child, so I'm not going to name her.
Good move.
So the parents bring Beverly. They go out to dinner, whatever they were doing, and Beverly's at home with the baby. And unbeknownst to her, at some point during the night, Daniel had crept into the house with a large hunting knife.
Wow.
And then he hid in the master bedroom until Beverly had put the baby to bed for the night. And as she was like leaving the baby's room and passing the master bedroom, Daniel like jumped out at her completely naked and holding this knife. Yeah. He jumps out of the darkness and he like hisses, if you scream, I'll kill you.
This dude is what, 14?
14.
Come on.
So he drags her into the bedroom and demands she takes off her clothes. He proceeds to rape this poor 13-year-old girl. And when he was finished, she jumped up, grabbed her clothing, and like fled to the bathroom and she locked herself in. A few minutes later, she gets a knock on the door and it's her rapist. And he's like, hey, you took some of my clothes by mistake.
What?
I know. So she cautiously opens the door to give him his clothing. And he says to her, quote, I live across town and go to another school. You don't know me, end quote. And then he took off.
Well, first of all, imagine if she kept his clothes. She would have had him dead to rights. Like, are these your clothes? But also, what a kind of like 14-year-old excuse is that? Like, so I'm not knowing this story, I can guarantee he goes to her school and he knows.
Oh, yeah. Well, he takes off and the Finns return home like not long after. And they called the police once Beverly had told them what happened. So the police get there, and when Beverly was describing her attacker, she told police she thought he might have been a local kid whose nickname was Speedy.
Okay.
But after hearing her description of the rapist, Mr. Finn thought it sounded a lot like someone he knew. His 14-year-old neighbor, Daniel Lee Corwin.
His neighbor? They live right next door, and the girl didn't know him?
No, she's there babysitting, remember?
Oh, right. Okay.
It's not her house.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Wow. Never mind. Take it all back. Maybe he didn't know her.
I'm jumping ahead, but years down the road, when he kind of gets caught for everything, one of the police talks to the neighbors and told them what they were looking at him for. And they said rape, aggravated rape. And the wife goes, yep, that sounds about right. Like, wow. She was not shocked in the least.
She had bad vibes from the beginning.
Well, and she figured her husband was right, that it was him who had raped the poor babysitter.
Yeah.
Well, just a few days later, Beverly's at school walking down the hall when she sees him.
I knew it. Kid
who had just traumatized and raped her just a few days before.
Because why else would he? Yeah, why else would he have gone after her? But it sounds like he was a random attacker, like he would just do this. But I feel like he had to know that she would be there.
Maybe he saw her get there, or maybe the neighbors had said, like, we're going to have a babysitter tonight.
Weird.
Well, there he is, standing right in front of her. So clearly he went to her school, and she went home and calls police. So they go and speak to Daniel, and he was home the night of the attack. Apparently Mr. and Mrs. Corwin had gone out that night, but Daniel was supposedly home with his siblings.
Mm.
So Mr. Corwin, his dad, is like, absolutely not. It couldn't have been Daniel, and I want you to give him a polygraph test. So the police are like, okay. So this kid takes 3 polygraphs, all came back as inconclusive.
No kidding.
Yep. And because there was no physical evidence, and because poor Beverly had named someone else, there was nothing that police could do, and Daniel Corwin got off scot-free.
Yeah, she put that doubt in their head. Well, there's a whole conversation here about, like, where there's smoke, there's fire.
Yeah. But
also the fact that, like, basically, he got away with it. So knowing how this kid's wired, it's like an open invitation to do it again.
Oh, and he does. That's exactly what he did.
Wow.
So now it's 1975, and he's 18 at this point. And one day he had an early dismissal from school because he and his family were going on a weekend trip. They were doing something with the church. So another student, her name was Brenda, they knew each other. They went to school together. They sat near each other in classes. Hmm. Well, she had an early dismissal that day also. So Brenda goes to the office, checks out, whatever, walks out of the school building, and she heads to her car. And once she gets to her car, she looks up and she sees Daniel sitting on the hood of the car parked next to her. And she says, "Hello, Daniel," because again, she knew who he was, and he responded by saying hi. So Brenda gets into her car and she bends down to pick up an 8-track tape that had fallen to the floor. Daniel climbed in the car, squeezed in next to her, and commanded her to move over.
He's so brazen. And like,
so brazen.
She knows you, dude. Right. What are you hoping to accomplish?
So she's like, "What are you doing? Like, is this a joke? Like, what are you doing?" So he tells her again to move over, but this time he pulls out a knife. So Brenda's basically in shock, obviously, and this isn't something that happens every day, especially not by someone you know so well.
Right.
So after a couple minutes of like back and forth, Brenda finally moves over and Daniel drives him out of the school lot to a secluded area just about 2 miles from the school.
He's definitely got an MO. Like, he operates the same way. Wow.
Yep. Well, when they arrive, Daniel, who's still holding the knife, he tells Brenda to undress and he proceeds to sexually assault her inside the car. So when he was finished, he barked at Brenda to get out of the car. And she's like, I'm not getting out of the car naked. So Daniel begrudgingly allowed her to dress herself. And then he pulls her out of the car and he drags her towards the back of the vehicle. And his original plan was to lock her in the trunk, but he couldn't get it open.
Oh.
And he's like, just getting angry. And he's like, "What the hell's wrong with this thing?" And
yeah.
Anytime Brenda tried to like speak or answer him, he would yell at her to shut up.
Why keep her alive? And I'm so glad she is, but why keep her alive? She literally saw you, dude, and was like, "Hey, Daniel."
Well, then without any warning, he takes his knife and he stabs her in the arm.
Oh, okay.
So when she tried to get away from him, he took the knife and he cuts her throat.
Oh, no way.
So she's bleeding profusely. When he pushes her to the ground, he stabs her in the stomach, withdraws the knife, and then stabs her again in between her breasts.
Oh, wow.
Oh, my God.
That's hard to get. That's tough to get through.
Yeah.
Wow.
So then he takes the knife, and Brenda is severely wounded at this point, can barely breathe, but she knew if she did not play dead, he was gonna try to kill her.
She plays dead. Can you imagine during an attack that could end your life at any second, you have to basically let every defense down and just lay there playing possum and hope that he leaves you alone, because you're done. If he decides not to, you're dead.
I cannot even imagine. Well, he clearly thought she was dead, so he covers her body with dirt and trash and branches, whatever was around. And then he found this wood plank and he covers her face with it. Like, he puts it over her head. And then, satisfied with his work, he gets in Brenda's car and drives away. And actually, he almost ran her over. Whether or not that was intentional, I don't know, but
probably not.
She thought he was going to run her over.
Gross.
So Brenda laid there bleeding, barely able to breathe for what seemed like an eternity until she was sure that Daniel was gone. Just like Wendy, this badass babe, brave and courageous young lady, she manages to drag herself to the closest road where a passing motorist picked her up and took her to the nearby gas station where they called the police.
It's like dramatic. It's harrowing.
Get this shit, though. The only reason she survived that stabbing to like her chest was because the knife hit exactly where her bra clasp was.
Oh, no kidding.
It was like one of those bras that opened in the front, and that tiny little piece of metal saved her life because it stopped the knife from like going deeper and hitting her heart or, you know, another major artery.
Those are always notoriously the toughest to open, so it makes sense that they're
tough.
Yeah,
they're tough.
Very hard. Wow, that's nuts, though.
I saw one article and it was kind of like, it's crazy how she kind of helped save her own life because she demanded that he give her her clothes back.
Yeah, because if she didn't, she's done.
Exactly. So I was like, that was really cool. Like, she's awesome.
I'm blown away at the circumstances that have to come together for some of these cases to either for people to live or people to die, or like the randomness of it all astounds me always.
You're right. And it's weird when you think about it. Like, why do some people make it and some people don't? Well, Brenda's taken to the hospital where she thankfully survives her attack, and she's obviously able to tell the police who her attacker was. Duh.
Yeah, it's Daniel.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Daniel had dumped her car and he had gotten a ride with a friend to Dairy Queen. They got a soda.
As one does.
Yeah. And then the friend dropped him off to meet his dad, because remember, the Corwin family was scheduled to go on a church trip.
Oh, I'm sure they have an image to uphold. Of course.
Exactly. Well, police quickly went after him, and I'm not even going into this side story, but there was a little bit of a police chase until the police caught him and arrested him with no other issues. So, this part of the case is where I'm listening to this audiobook, and I had to turn it off because I was getting so angry. We're not going to go into this entire battle, but basically, when Daniel was arrested and put in jail for this rape and attempted murder, his family was adamant that this was a misunderstanding. And remember, the Corbins are this perfect church-going nuclear family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So when their congregation heard what happened, they too were in complete denial that sweet, kind Daniel could ever commit such a horrific act.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember Debbie Dykus, the disc jockey who was killed in our garden?
Yeah, the disc jockey.
Ronald Blanchard, his family. And he went to this church and was this well-respected member. They lived in a church. It was like an apartment above a church. And they could not believe it. It's these small towns that just, it's one of our own.
Yeah.
No way they could be responsible for something like this.
Perverts don't wear signs that say they're perverts.
Yeah.
I don't want to generalize and say the entire congregation, but a majority of this congregation rallied around the Corwin family and fought for Daniel to either not be punished for the monster that he was, but they believed he just needed some spiritual guidance.
Ah, yes.
And this is a small town, so word travels fast. And even though Brenda had visible injuries because she was almost murdered, she has stab wounds, people around town manipulated the narrative and essentially victim blamed this 16-year-old rape victim who was
awful.
Like seconds away from being murdered. I was getting so angry. Like, the author is just, I know he's just explaining what happened. It's not his fault. Like, I'm not saying that he did anything wrong, but I was getting so angry. Like, these God-fearing church members are calling Brenda a whore, saying she's wild and loose, and trashing her around town, spreading lies that she lured Daniel.
Are you kidding me right now? Like, people need to pull their heads out of their asses and see the world for what it is. And it's evil. It is an evil place.
Right.
It was in 1987. It is now. It just, open your eyes.
And they just did not want to. Like, they were so blind to this. Luckily, Brenda's father was really well known too, and he was well connected in town. But half the town was on Brenda's side and half the town was on Daniel's side.
How about being on the side of the girl who almost got murdered and has scars to show it?
Like, exactly. And especially for his family to know that there was the accusation with the babysitter and then for this to happen and you still to believe it's not happening.
Yeah, that's not right.
Well, eventually the victim shaming got so bad that Brenda's dad just refused to allow Brenda to testify in court. He's like, I do not want my child traumatized even more than she already is. Yeah, and I want to give credit to the prosecutor. It was a gentleman named Bob Odom, because he was under intense pressure to let Daniel off the hook. Like, these lovely church folk used intimidation, threats. They're threatening this prosecutor so he would either lessen the charges against Daniel or drop them completely.
I mean, I'm not surprised. Sometimes the most religious people are the most evil.
Thankfully, Bob Odom was not having any of it. Like, he wanted Daniel to pay for what he did, but he also wanted to protect Brenda as best as he could. So he ended up offering Daniel a plea bargain. He needed to plead guilty, and then they would leave his punishment up to the judge. And Daniel's defense team agreed to this because they felt like if they went to a trial, a jury would lock him up for a long time. And at least with this plea bargain, he hopefully wouldn't get that much time, or maybe even none at all, if the judge was sympathetic and recommended hospitalization versus incarceration.
Yeah, you gotta roll the dice.
To which I say you cannot fix this demon creature from hell with hospitalization, but luckily the judge agreed with me because he sentenced Daniel to 40 years in prison.
Pretty good.
Don't start celebrating because while Daniel was in prison, he was a model inmate.
Of course he was.
As most men are in a men's prison with no women to attack, but moving on.
Yeah.
As we talked about earlier, Daniel always wanted to be the teacher's pet. You know, he needed that approval. He needed that praise. So, of course, he's the perfect prisoner. And he even managed to suck up to the warden, who would commend Daniel for his work ethic and good behavior. Gag me.
Yeah, there's that validation you craved.
Oh, my God.
Ridiculous.
Well, Daniel begins taking classes in prison. He took college courses, but he also took woodshop classes. And it was there that he befriended the woodshop teacher, a man named Ben Pruitt. And Pruitt was really impressed by Daniel and his carpentry skills. So yet again, this absolute monster degenerate was somehow able to scam everyone into thinking he was just this good old boy who got mixed up into something bad. And because our justice system is a joke, see, I'm switched from last week when I was happy with it because it wasn't Canada. Happy.
Oh, how quick we turn.
Oh, yeah. Well, Daniel Corwin was paroled after serving 9 years of his 40-year sentence. 9 years.
Wow.
And there's a couple reasons for this. Not only was he a model inmate, but the population in the surrounding areas had grown exponentially. And with that came more crime. So the Texas prisons were severely overcrowded. So, you know, let's release a rapist murderer. Why not? So now it's 1984 and 26-year-old Daniel is out of prison. So again, he had duped everyone, including that Ben Pruitt guy, into thinking he was a reformed good guy, whatever. And Pruitt wanted to give Daniel a second chance. And I'm going to keep my opinions to myself on that one. About a year after Daniel's release from prison, Pruitt offered Daniel a job working for him as a carpenter, which Daniel gladly accepted this job. However, Pruitt made him agree to two terms. The first was that Daniel would promise to stay out of trouble, because nothing's more worth it than a pinky swear from a rapist murderer.
Got it.
Yeah. And the second term he had to agree to was that Daniel would go back to school. So, of course, Daniel agrees.
Sure.
So things are going quite well for Daniel. He's out of prison. He has this great job. His parents bought him a brand new pickup truck because let's reward his behavior. He's going back to school. He's taking courses at Texas A&M, and he even has a steady girlfriend, a young lady named Becky.
What a lucky gal.
Well, this is icky. Apparently Daniel had babysat Becky when she was younger.
Ew.
So I feel like there's some sort of sick and twisted mindset that like Sigmund Freud would love to dig into, but I don't have the time or the energy to dig into that shit show.
God,
point being, things are going well for Dan. And he had recently moved from Temple, Texas, like where his family lived, to Huntsville, Texas, where Pruitt's company and his clients were.
It's like letting a wild animal back out into the world. It's like there are too many temptations.
For a little while, Daniel seemed to be staying on the straight and narrow. But by kind of like the end of 1986, things are beginning to fall apart. Things aren't going great for Becky and Daniel. They had been strong for a while, and they even talked about marriage. They went and looked at rings. But there were issues, and I think a lot of this is kind of like Ted Bundy's ex, Liz, where certain things would happen, but they would talk themselves out of it being a more serious issue.
Yeah, because you don't want to believe it.
Does that make sense? Exactly. You don't want to believe it.
Right.
Well, they definitely didn't have a thriving sex life. Apparently, Daniel was unable to finish the job.
Oh, poor guy. Well, again, I'm no Catherine Ramsden, but I suspect that regular sex, like vanilla sex, wasn't good enough. But guy gets rock hard if you put a knife to her throat. That would be my
exactly because he was able to do it when he was raping, but not with exactly. Yeah. Well, at the same time that this was all happening, Daniel had been kicked out of the university because his grades got so bad. But he's pulling a John List move, and he's getting up every day with his backpack, going to school. and coming home, but not actually going to school. Like, you think no one's going to figure that out?
No.
Yeah. So that's happening. The couple breaks up. And again, there were a few issues in the relationship, but a big one was the distance between them. She was in college at a different university, so that was tough. She also had figured out that he was not at all good with money and was in a lot of debt.
Well, look at his family. Look at his role models.
Exactly. So things are falling apart. And by the beginning of 1987, the sick and disgusting urges that once controlled him came back with a vengeance.
Only a matter of time.
Yes. And we will come back to this, but for now, let's go back to where we started. So we have three women. We have Deborah Ewing, who was abducted, raped, and murdered. We have Mary Risinger, who was murdered in front of her child. And we have Wendy, who was abducted, raped, and all but murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Wendy survived. We know that. And she worked with Karen Taylor, who created an amazingly accurate sketch. And like I said earlier, within 1 hour of the sketch being released to the media, a prison guard sees this sketch and he's like, I got you. Like, I know who that is.
Awesome.
So police go out and arrest Daniel for the attack on Wendy. And by this point, Wendy's car had been fully processed by forensic techs, and they found a fingerprint, which was a perfect match to Daniel.
Great.
So he was charged with aggravated sexual assault, attempted murder, and aggravated kidnapping for what he did to Wendy. So by now, Daniel's in custody, and he didn't really put up a fight or try to defend himself. It was like he knew he was caught, and he actually ended up pleading guilty and avoided trial. And within 3 months of being arrested, he was sentenced to 99 years in prison. So this was quick.
Yeah, and some of these guys feel like it's a weight off their shoulder. Like, they're almost waiting to be caught, and, like, they don't have to live this lie anymore. Like, going to school, doing all these things. Like, it had to build. The pressure had to build.
Yeah, that's kind of exhausting.
Yeah, right.
So Daniel's in jail for 99 years. We think this would be the end of our case, but it was not. So investigators have the unsolved murders of Deborah and Mary. Because remember, he's in jail for Wendy.
Right.
But investigators are suspicious that Daniel may have had a hand in the murders of Deborah and Mary. And Daniel had actually been looked at in Deborah's abduction and murder because Ben Pruitt and Daniel had recently installed cabinets in the Vision Center.
Oh, get out. So that's where he got the first urge. He probably saw her.
Right. That's where he saw her. So once police found this out and they saw Daniel's record, they were like, we got to talk to this guy. So they actually brought Daniel and Ben Pruitt in to do like a joint interview. And they point blank asked Daniel if he had hurt Deborah. And they asked for his alibi. They went in on him for a while. But this entire time, Daniel was like calm. He was cool. His story remained the same, no matter how many times they asked him or, you know, how they, I don't want to talk poorly about the police, but sometimes they try to trip you up. They might manipulate their tone and, you know, well, that's what they're trying to do to Daniel. But the whole time he's just like super chill about it. And he gives his alibi. He had been here, there, everywhere, running errands, whatever. And then he drove to Temple, Texas to see his parents. And this actually reminds me of the Ardeth Woods case. When police kind of mapped out Daniel's alibi, they didn't think he would have had enough time to abduct, yeah, rape, and murder Deborah.
That happens a lot in these cases behind the scenes. Like, they will drive these routes to disprove an alibi. Mm-hmm. And you do it on different times of day, different traffic patterns, different just to see if you can make it work. And a lot of times they can't.
Well, and that's kind of what happened here. So between that and the fact that he was able to fool even veteran detectives with his cool, calm attitude, yeah, they crossed him off as a suspect.
Yeah, if he would have just stopped, he might have got away with some of these.
Yeah, he probably would have. But now, all these years later, investigators wanted answers. They wanted to close the cases on Mary and Deborah. So they sent a veteran detective, a gentleman named A.P. Merritt, to speak with Daniel in prison. And this would go on over several weeks. It reminded me of when Dr. Smalden met with Gacy and, like, Gacy slowly started telling mm-hmm. him more and more.
Yeah.
Because originally, Daniel was quiet, standoffish. He described Daniel as meek, which we just heard that word a couple weeks ago in one of the cases. Yeah.
Maybe it was something they described people as back in the 80s.
I guess. Well, Daniel eventually begins to open up to Detective Merritt. And So Merrick gets special permission from the prison to take Daniel on a little day trip. So he takes Daniel to some of the crime scenes. They go to the car wash where Mary was murdered. They go to the spot where he had dumped Deborah's body. And Detective Merritt would later say that once Daniel was at the location, it was like he went into a trance and he began recounting all the gory details of his murders. Wow. And he would later tell Merritt that during his attacks, he entered a trance or fog-like state where he couldn't stop himself or remember much until after the crimes were over. Sure, bro.
Yeah. Yes. Another model citizen who blacked out doing something that no human, like, no normal person would ever consider doing.
Yeah. Why did killers always like have random amnesia?
Because they don't want to. They're embarrassed. Like a lot of, they don't want to admit to police what they did.
And this guy who's been a suck up his whole life, he definitely doesn't want to admit to this.
It's going to ruin my image.
Well, at that point, he had pretty much admitted. And that's when he goes on to admit another murder that I don't know that they would have ever linked him to.
It's amazing what happens when they can build trust with a suspect like that. Man.
I kind of want to tell the suspect, like, are you dumb? They're clearly using you for...
Stop talking.
Keep being dumb, please.
Yeah, please, for all our sakes.
So this other attack, rape, and murder took place in February of 1987. So this was the first one that happened after his life started going to shit. The breakup, the getting kicked out of school, all that. So this was like the first one in 1987, and then Deborah was the second, and Mary was the third. This murder had taken place in Normangee, Texas. The town is 45 now, just northwest.
Degrees.
45 minutes. Shut up. Oh, it's been a day.
All right, Magellan.
Magellan. Normangee's about 45 minutes northwest of Huntsville, so not super far, but far enough that these crimes weren't really connected.
Right.
So the victim is a 72-year-old Alice Martin.
What?
Alice had been married to her husband Alvin for 55 years, and the couple were well-known and well-respected fixtures in their small rural community. And I do mean small. Like, at the time of Alice's murder, there were less than 700 people who called this town home. Yeah, very, very small. So while they were both retired at this point, Alice and Alvin had both held coveted positions in town. Alice had worked for USPS for 25 years, and she was actually even the postmistress for 5 years prior to her retirement in 1978. And her husband, Alvin, he had spent almost two decades working as the commissioner for Madison County.
Oh, wow. They were high up.
Yeah. So they're well known, especially in a town that small with these positions. And the couple had grown children and were now not only proud grandparents, but also proud great-grandparents. I think they had three kids, eight grandkids, and one great-grandkid. I think that's what I read.
Interesting.
So big family, lots of love. And Alice was described as a petite but nervy little woman who was incredibly active in her church and was very proud of her devotion to her religion. And her home was known as like a gathering place for family and friends who knew that they would always could go there and they'd be treated to some of Alice's amazing cooking. Like everyone talked about how great her cooking was. So it's Friday, February 13th, and Alice had started her day as she had every day for the last decade. She had had heart surgery 10 years prior. So every day since then, she began her day with a 3-mile walk. And we're talking rain, shine, didn't matter. She was doing it.
Good for her.
So that morning, Alice got up around 6, and about 7:15 a.m., she took her dog and the two drove over to the Martins Church, which wasn't too far from their house. Alice parked in the lot, and she and the pup started their walk down what sources called a farm-to-market road, which I had never heard. I didn't know what that meant.
I have no idea what that is.
Yeah, well, apparently it's a state-designated roadway that connects like small rural farming towns to bigger cities, really? And the route is marked with an FM. For farm to market.
That's interesting. I don't know if they still do that today.
I don't know, but I had to Google it because I was like, I don't know what that means.
I'm interested in this.
This daily walk generally began, like I said, around 7:15-ish or so, and the 3 miles took Alice roughly an hour. So when she had not gotten back by 10 a.m., her family's starting to get worried, and one of her grandsons goes looking for her. So when he reached, he knew where she went. Again, same route for 10 years. So when he reached the church parking lot, he was relieved because he saw Alice's car. But that quickly turned into panic when he saw Alice's dog standing next to the car alone.
Oh, no.
Like, the dog's just sitting there.
Never a good sign.
No. So after a cursory, like, look around the property, the grandson called police to report his grandmother missing. And the police, who knew Alice super well, like, they're all friends in this tiny little community, they jumped on this disappearance, like, immediately. And within hours, there were hundreds of people just scouring the area for any sign of Alice. But sadly, Alice's naked and mutilated body would be found the next day on Saturday, February 14th, in a wooded area in Robertson County, which is about 15 miles from Alice's home. And it would later be determined that this poor elderly woman had been raped, stabbed, and probably strangled. It was tough to tell.
This guy's all over the place, too. What's the young yeah. girls? All, it's weird.
To say that the small rural town was in shock is like the understatement of the century. And the police were determined this was their friend, so they were determined to solve Alice's murder like as quickly as possible. But there were no leads, and her case just got ice cold within days. And Alice's case, I don't believe it was ever tied to Mary or Deborah. There was some sources that alluded to they thought Daniel may have something to do with it, but nowhere did it explain why.
And doesn't really fit. It's I exactly. would never link these together, but
and it's 45 know. Minutes away.
Yeah.
So it's not and it's not like his hometown. It's not, it's just a random town.
Yeah, strange. Unless they found his DNA somewhere now, but I doubt that.
That's yeah. So we've had Alice's murder, then we had Deborah's murder, and then after Mary's murder on Halloween, things stayed quiet for several months, but then just shy of a year after killing Mary, he would strike again when he attacked Wendy.
Got it.
So in March of 1989, Daniel was charged for the murders of Deborah Ewing, Mary Rissinger, and Alice Martin. The capital murder trial began in March of 1990 in Montgomery County, Texas. And they kind of consolidated a bunch of charges from multiple counties. The prosecution presented circumstantial forensic evidence, including hairs found in Corwin's truck, which was linked to the victims. And they also introduced Corwin's detailed confessions, which demonstrated his intimate knowledge of the crime specifics. Like, he knew things that only police and the killer would know. So psychiatrists who evaluated him would testify that Daniel acted on impulse and high risk factors, which triggered these violent episodes. But they said Corwin himself did not fully understand or remember the motivation behind his actions.
Well, yeah, because he was in a trance.
Yeah, of course. Sure you were. This trial was pretty uneventful. He pretty much just kept his head down the whole time, didn't really say much. I know that Alvin, Alice's husband, apparently broke down and broke everyone's hearts while on the stand. Sure. And I think it was Deborah's father, like, blew up and just started yelling at him, which both reactions are completely understandable.
Absolutely. Yeah.
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 Well, during this trial, when it was over, Corwin was convicted on March 17th, 1990, and he became the first person convicted under Texas's serial killer statute.
What's that?
Do you know what that is?
I don't.
So basically, it allowed a killer to be charged for like all of his crimes that he did in one trial.
I got you. Okay.
So that's why they could do all three murders in one trial. Yeah.
Cool. Okay.
And the jury recommended the death penalty after less than 35 minutes of deliberation.
Surprised it took that long.
Yep. Well, Corwin's appeals, he tried to appeal several times. They were all eventually exhausted. His conviction and sentence were affirmed by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals in 1993. He was incarcerated and spent that time on death row, like in Texas, which couldn't have been very much fun.
Right.
And like his legal team tried a ton of different maneuvers with clemency or retrials, but his death sentence stood. And on December 7th, 1998, Danny Corwin was executed by lethal injection.
Good.
Daniel's final words were stupid, and I'm not going to waste anyone's time because he doesn't matter. I will say he, of course, tried to say he was so remorseful, and maybe he was, but that doesn't bring Mary, Alice, or Deborah back. So, no. And it also doesn't erase the horrors of what he did to the 13-year-old babysitter.
Or the 3-year-old Kristen.
Kristen, or what he did to Brenda or Wendy. So you can be as remorseful as you want. It doesn't matter. And he, of course, finished his little soliloquy with this pathetic, self-righteous bullshit. When he said, quote, "The death penalty causes pain on both sides, and I hope society will consider the weight of this punishment very carefully. May God bless you all."
I have no words for that.
Shut the hell up.
It is too late for me to go off on this guy.
I know. It's bad time.
Yeah.
Well, I hate to say this at the end, but I came across this in my research. Little Kristen, Mary's daughter from that Halloween night murder, she passed away in 2018 in a two-vehicle accident.
Oh, my God.
She was only 34 years old, and it looked like from her obituary I got that she was a wife and a mother to two young kids.
That is hard. What a cursed life.
Isn't that so sad? I think she was a passenger, and I think the driver of the car passed away as well. And it's just so spooky. Like, both mother and daughter passed away so tragically at such young ages, leaving behind young children.
Yeah, and like, not, I don't know, one was in a car wash, but like in your car too. Like, there's a lot of...
Oh, yeah. I didn't think about that.
Oof. Man, that's tragic.
Well, I'll bring us back up, though, by ending on something pretty amazing. So in 2005, Wendy Gant was interviewed for this book that I mentioned, Brian Burroughs' book. And she said, quote, "I have had a great life during my 38 years and only one bad day," end quote.
Man.
Which is pretty awesome, I think.
I have the capability to look at life that way. I had a bad day today. I'm like, well, I should just quit and move to Mexico.
I'm in. Cabo, here we come. Well, that is the wild case of the kind of forgotten serial killer, Daniel Lee Corwin, and how, thanks to Wendy's bravery and Karen Taylor's incredible forensic artistry, this monster was put away and eventually put down.
Man, I'm glad we didn't call this hand turkeys, because there's so many great artists that we're featuring that I think that would be a complete disservice. So
I think so, too.
Our better judgment prevailed. Yes.
Look at us making smart decisions.
Oh, man. I don't have anything to talk about tonight. Like, today was a day. I know you had one, too.
It's been a day. It's a Monday, which I feel like is always super exhausting.
But I feel like everybody came in hot today. Like, this new show I'm on is bonkers. And I'm just like, I'm shifting roles a little bit to do some other stuff. And I have to be so vague with how I talk about this.
Cryptic, I know.
So cryptic. But I'm doing some different things that are taking a lot of time and effort and thought power. So bandwidth by 8 p.m. when a recording is shot.
I actually said to my boss today, I was like, I'm trying to finish something for the podcast. Like, this needs to stop, meaning my work.
Well, great job. Thank you for, I know this came together on in like 24 hours. So great job getting this out. Seriously.
It did. Maybe that's why I'm tired.
I don't know. Well, Halloween, we just passed Halloween in our, not in our recording schedule, but in our lives.
Yes.
And I definitely invoked the dad tax. I explained to the kids that when you go out, if I'm taking you around the neighborhood, there is a surcharge for your safety.
Of course.
So think of me as security. So every 3 candy bars you get, depending what they are, one of them comes to me. And they said, absolutely not, because they ended up with hundreds of candy bars. So I would have, as a diabetic, I should probably.
Yeah, you'd probably be dead.
It's a life lesson. I'm trying to explain taxes to them. So like, lay out all your candy, and I'm just going to come in and take a handful and like sweep it into a bag of mine. And I'll be like, that's taxes. So it's not about the candy, guys. It's about shepherding you into adulthood and understanding that people are going to take half of what you owe.
Yeah, shit ain't free. Welcome to the real world.
Yeah. Now turn over your Nestle Crunch.
Exactly. See, I feel like you should take like the majority of it and be like, you did all the work, but I'm taking it.
Yes, but I'm your boss, technically.
Exactly. Well, on that note, let us know what you think about this case. Let us know if you know about Daniel Lee Corwin, because I'd be interested to know how many people do know about him.
Agreed.
So you know where you can tell us on our socials, Insta, Facebook, TikTok, at Murder Unscripted. You can get us on our Reddit page, at Murder Unscripted. You can email us, murderunscriptedpod@gmail.com, or you can leave a note on our website, www.murderunscriptedpod.com.
Did you say Reddit? I'm only half paying attention.
I did say okay. Reddit. Yes, I know. Yes. We're both falling asleep. So on that note, I hope everyone has a lovely night. Stay safe, stay hydrated. And if nothing else from this episode, remember that perverts do not wear signs that say they're perverts.
This guy might as well just wear a sign that said, "My name's Daniel. I'm here to do bad things to you."
Like, super hi, pervert. I'm Ted. Hi, yeah. I'm Ted.
What an idiot.
Bye. Adios.